All right, so let's do 50 high yield endocrine questions. Everybody, thank you so much for the comments, the new subscriptions, everything. I really appreciate the support. And if you haven't checked out the YouTube page, please do cram the pants on YouTube. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. Question one, patient presents to the office with polyuria and polydipsia. He has a family history of diabetes and he wants to be tested to see if he is diabetic. He last ate 2 hours ago and his blood glucose in the office was 156. His A1C comes back and reveals a result of 6.3, and his 2-hour glucose tolerance test revealed a blood glucose of 212. Which one of these labs can definitively make the diagnosis of diabetes in this patient? So the one lab test he had would be the 2-hour glucose tolerance test with a blood glucose of 212. Let's go over the results that did not make the cut. So his blood glucose in the office was 156. That was not fasting though, so that couldn't diagnose with the 126 or higher, which is one of the factors that we can use to diagnose. His A1C came back 6.3, but we need a 6.5 to diagnose diabetes. And then the glucose tolerance test, which after you give 75 grams of glucose, 2 hours later, if they're 200 or higher, can make a positive diagnosis. And this patient happened to be 212. So that's what makes the diagnosis of diabetes. The only one we didn't mention would be the random plasma glucose of 200 or higher in the presence of classic diabetes symptoms or complications like polyuria, polydipsia. Question number two. 66-year-old male presents to the office today because his diabetes is out of control lately, and he would like some help getting his blood sugars back to normal. He only currently takes metformin 1000 milligrams BID. You discuss a few different medications with him, including glipizide, insulin glargine, and empagliflozin. He states his only fear with starting a new medication is low blood sugars. Which one of these medications discussed with the patient is least likely to cause hypoglycemia? So the only one discussed that would be not likely to cause hypoglycemia would be empagliflozin. The other two, glargine, which is a basal insulin, as we know, all types of insulin have the potential to cause hypoglycemia, and then glipizide, which is sulfonylurea. It's an insulin secretagogue, which is notorious for causing low blood sugars. Glipizide, glimepiride, glibiride, all the sulfonylureas can cause low blood sugar. So the only one, the empagliflozin, which is an SGLT2 inhibitor, does not usually cause low blood sugar. So that would be the choice for this patient. Question three, what is the most common type of thyroid cancer? Most common type of thyroid cancer, that would be papillary thyroid carcinoma. About 8 out of 10 cases is papillary thyroid carcinoma. Question four, a non-pregnant adult with subclinical hypothyroidism should be treated with thyroid hormone replacement like levothyroxine when their TSH reaches what level? That would be a TSH of 10 or higher. So 10 or higher, virtually all sources agree upon treating once this patient's reached this level to prevent cardiovascular complications. Anything less than that, like 4.5 to 10, different sources are going to have different opinions whether or not to treat. It's kind of controversial, but 10 or higher TSH and subclinical hypothyroidism, almost all sources agree, treat at that level with levothyroxine or another thyroid hormone replacement. Question five, 27-year-old female with history of bipolar disorder presents to the office complaining of fatigue, constipation, and weight gain. Labs are ordered, and it is determined she is biochemically hypothyroid. What medication is this patient likely taking that led to her diagnosis of hypothyroidism? So the medication she's likely taking would be lithium. So the history of bipolar we saw in the vignette, that's a first line medication for bipolar is lithium. So you just have to know that lithium can absolutely cause hypothyroidism. It's a board favorite to ask about that. So when you're on lithium, you actually have to have your TSH checked about every 6 to 12 months because hypothyroidism is so prevalent with this med. The other popular med to ask is probably going to be amiodarone. That's another one that can cause hypothyroidism. So anytime you see bipolar mentioned, remember lithium, and lithium can cause hypothyroidism. Question six, 37-year-old female presents to the office complaining that she is having trouble losing weight despite following a strict diet and exercising daily. On physical exam, you note central obesity, thin extremities, oily skin, and striae across her abdomen. A screening test to check for excess of what hormone should be checked in this patient? So that would be serum cortisol. This patient has pretty classic findings of Cushing syndrome, weight gain, striae, which is those stretch marks on the abdomen, oily skin, thin extremities, central obesity. The only thing that's missing from the vignette, because I didn't want to make it too obvious, is a buffalo hump. And with Cushing's, we know we're looking for increased cortisol levels. Once we establish the increase in cortisol, then we can use differentiating tests to see if it's Cushing's disease or an ectopic ACTH producing source. Question seven, patient with secondary hypothyroidism will have an abnormality in which part of the hypothalamic pituitary thyroid axis. So secondary hypothyroidism, that is going to be the pituitary gland. So secondary hypothyroidism is that caused by a TSH deficiency. As we know, the pituitary gland is responsible for TSH production. So anything like a pituitary tumor, Sheehan syndrome, which is that postpartum pituitary necrosis, they can all be responsible for secondary hypothyroid disorders. Question 8, what is the most common cause overall for Cushing's syndrome? Most common cause overall for Cushing's syndrome, that's going to be long-term high-dose use of glucocorticoids. Question 9, in a patient with diabetic ketoacidosis, DKA, after checking capillary glucose levels and confirming urine ketones, to confirm the diagnosis, what is the first therapeutic intervention that should be started in these patients? So you've confirmed DKA. What's the first thing you're going to do to treat them? That's going to be start IV fluids. So the first crucial step in treatment of DKA is infusion of isotonic saline. These patients are severely dehydrated. After that, or at the same time, you can start to replete potassium, give insulin, but right away, these patients need IV fluids. Question 10, a 69-year-old female with type 2 diabetes for over 25 years presents to the office today complaining of early satiety, epigastric discomfort, and postprandial nausea and bloating for many months. What is the likely diagnosis in this patient? So in this patient, the likely diagnosis is going to be something known as diabetic gastroparesis. So diabetes is the most frequently recognized disease associated with gastroparesis. And what gastroparesis is, it's just a delayed gastric emptying. And it's caused from years of damage from diabetes. It leads to autonomic neuropathy, which affects the vagal nerve, and just basically reduces the frequency of contractions of the stomach, of antral contractions, leading to this slowed emptying of the stomach we see in diabetic patients. Question 11, a patient with nephrogenic diabetes insipidus will likely have what response in urine output after a desmopressin ADH stimulation test is performed? So a patient with nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, you give them desmopressin, which is artificial ADH, what's going to happen to their urine output? Nothing. There's going to be no change. You're going to have continued production of large amounts of dilute urine because this patient has nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. So there's no problem with ADH. It's the kidneys are just ignoring it. They're insensitive to ADH. You compare that to central, which is a lack of ADH production. You give somebody with central diabetes insipidus ADH, desmopressin, and they're going to have a reduction in urinary output. They're going to improve. So I used to remember diabetes insipidus, the DIA in diabetes insipidus. In central, the DIA stands for decrease in ADH. And in nephrogenic, the DIA in diabetes insipidus stands for decrease in acknowledgement because the kidneys aren't acknowledging the ADH. Question 12, what medication class, if given to a patient with pheochromocytoma, before initiating treatment with alpha adrenergic blockers like phenoxybenzamine, can cause unopposed alpha constriction and lead to hypertensive crisis? So what med before giving alpha blockers can lead to this hypertensive crisis in a pheochromocytoma patient? It's going to be beta blockers. So after you've initiated treatment with your alpha blockers and you've achieved adequate alpha adrenergic blockade, then you can start your beta blockers like propranolol, metoprolol. This is normally done preoperatively, but you never start beta blockers before alpha blockers. You can cause hypertensive crisis in a patient with a pheochromocytoma. Question 13, what is the most common cause of hypothyroidism in the U.S.? So that is going to be Hashimoto thyroiditis. It's a chronic autoimmune hypothyroidism. And it's the most common cause in the U.S. of primary hypothyroidism and other parts of the world that they call iodine-sufficient areas of the world. So the U.S., obviously, we don't typically have iodine deficiency. Other parts of the world that do, that's going to be your most common cause of hypothyroidism. But here in the U.S., it's going to be Hashimoto thyroiditis. Question 14, a patient with history of Graves' disease presents with bilateral, scaly, non-pitting induration of the skin of the lower extremities with brown patches spread throughout. What is the name of the likely diagnosis in this patient? So that's going to be something known as pretibial myxedema. It's an autoimmune reaction that can be seen in patients with Graves' disease, and it's caused from this excess or this accumulation of something known as glycosaminoglycans, which collects in the dermis of the skin, can cause these swollen red or brown patches and this non-pitting edema, which is key because that differentiates it from other causes of lower leg edema like CHF, which has pitting edema. So this is non-pitting. That's kind of the key to the vignette there. Question 15, when treating a patient with Graves' disease, which medication should be used in the first trimester? So pregnant patient Graves' disease, what med are you going to use in the first trimester? That's going to be your PTU, your propylthiazide. So you use PTU in the first trimester, and then you can start on methimazole after that. So PTU in the first trimester, then you can switch to methimazole. And really, PTU in the first trimester is really the only time you use PTU over methimazole. Methimazole is generally preferred, but first trimester, you can't use methimazole. The way that I used to remember that, PTU stands for pregnancy trimester uno. That's how you remember you use PTU in the first trimester. Then you can switch over to methimazole. Some guidelines say you can use PTU the whole time if you wanted to, but most guidelines are going to say PTU first trimester, methimazole for the rest. Question 16, a patient develops bladder cancer and is suspected that one of the medications he uses for diabetes is to blame. Which diabetes medication is this patient likely taking? So the med this patient's likely taking that led to bladder cancer would be pioglitazone. Stroke carries an increased risk for bladder cancer. It's in the TZD class along with rosiglitazone. The way that I used to remember pioglitazone is associated with bladder cancer is I just would remember pioglitazone. So you think of peeing and then you think of the bladder. Remember, it's associated with bladder cancer. Question 17, a patient with Cushing's disease, which is a pituitary cause, after administration of high-dose dexamethasone, will likely have what response in their serum cortisol levels? So that would be a suppression of serum cortisol. So Cushing's disease, a pituitary source, is the only type that will suppress with high-dose dexamethasone. All the other ectopic sources of Cushing's syndrome, like adrenal tumor, ectopic ACTH-producing tumor, steroids, they're not going to suppress in that high-dose dexamethasone. It's only your Cushing's disease, your pituitary source, that will. Question 18, a 47-year-old female presents to the office 2 weeks post-op after having a thyroidectomy performed. She complains of muscle cramping, muscle spasms, as well as a tingling sensation in her extremities. An ECG is performed and prolongation of the QT interval is visualized. What is the likely cause of her symptoms? So likely cause of her symptoms is going to be hypocalcemia. So she has an iatrogenic cause of hypoparathyroidism. And we see this in patients who recently had a thyroidectomy performed. It can cause about 3% of hypoparathyroidisms after thyroidectomy. So during the surgery, whether they by accident cut out some of the parathyroid glands, there was a thermal injury from the cauterization to the parathyroid glands, whatever the case, they destroyed or removed the glands, and it led to hypoparathyroidism with resultant hypocalcemia, which this patient has a classic presentation, paresthesias, muscle weakness, and then most importantly, that prolongation of QT interval on ECG. Question 19, a 37-year-old female presents to the office today because she has not had her period in 4 months. She is not sexually active and denies any chance of pregnancy. She also complains of headaches and a milky discharge from her breast. What is the first-line medication class for the likely diagnosis? So that would be dopamine agonists like cabergoline, bromocriptine. So the patient in this vignette with amenorrhea, galactorrhea, headaches, which is caused from a compression from the adenoma, likely has a prolactinoma. It's the most common type of pituitary adenoma. And the reason we use dopamine agonists, well, the primary function of dopamine is to inhibit prolactin. So dopamine agonists, which mimic the action of dopamine, are going to decrease prolactin secretion and synthesis. Question 20. Multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1 is a rare autosomal dominant disorder characterized by predisposition to tumors, most commonly in what three areas of the body? So that is going to be your three P's, parathyroid, pancreas, and pituitary. The clinical spectrum is kind of expanded. Some sources include the duodenum, adrenal, but most commonly the one you need to know for the boards is going to be your three P's, your parathyroid, pancreas, and pituitary for multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1. Question 21, a 56-year-old male with history of diabetes presents to the office today to review recent lab results. His labs show he is deficient in vitamin B12. Which medication is he likely taking for his diabetes that caused a deficiency in vitamin B12? So that is going to be metformin. Metformin can reduce intestinal absorption of vitamin B12 and cause deficiency, vitamin B12 deficiency, in about 5 to 10% of patients taking the medication. Question 22, what is the most aggressive type of thyroid cancer? So by far, that's going to be anaplastic thyroid carcinoma. So it's extremely aggressive, which is actually quite different from the other types of thyroid cancers. And the median survival time from diagnosis is in the range from about 3 to 7 months. Question 23, how soon after the initiation of thyroid hormone replacement, like with levothyroxine, in a patient with primary hypothyroidism, should the TSH be checked? So that is going to be 4 to 6 weeks. 4 to 6 weeks after you start levothyroxine or whatever thyroid hormone you're using, Armour thyroid, etc. You check the TSH to see if you're giving enough or too much, and then you can make the adjustments from there. So 4 to 6 weeks after initiation. Question 24, 42-year-old male presents today to the office for routine labs. The results of the labs show an elevated TSH level and free T4 levels, which are within normal limits. So elevated TSH, normal free T4. Patient is otherwise healthy and asymptomatic. What diagnosis should be suspected in this patient? So you should be suspecting subclinical hypothyroidism. So isolated increased TSH with normal serum free T4 in the absence of any symptoms or clinical manifestations of hypothyroidism, you should be thinking subclinical hypothyroidism. So remember that isolated increased TSH, really no symptoms for the most part. Sometimes you can have these mild, vague, nonspecific symptoms. Question 25. Physical exam is performed on a newborn female due to abnormalities detected at birth. Newborn has dry skin, swelling around the eyes, enlargement of the tongue, and an umbilical hernia palpated on exam. What nutritional deficiencies should be suspected in the mother of the newborn? So we should be suspecting an iodine deficiency in the mother. So this newborn has classic symptoms of untreated congenital hypothyroidism. It's also known as cretinism. So she has macroglossia, which is the enlarged tongue, umbilical hernia, facial edema, dry skin. They're all classic findings. And in developing countries, the most common cause is lack of maternal iodine intake. Here in the U.S., it's pretty uncommon, like I mentioned before, because we have, not only do we have screening programs, but we have iodine added to our salt and plenty of other food. So iodine deficiency is not common here. Question 26, 37-year-old female presents to the office today complaining of persistent fatigue combined with nausea, generalized abdominal pain, and a brownish discoloration on her hands, elbows, and knees. Labs are ordered and reveal elevated serum potassium levels and a blood glucose of 63. What is the likely diagnosis in this patient? So that's going to be primary adrenocortical insufficiency, also known as Addison's disease. This patient has chronic adrenocortical insufficiency, which is evident by the fatigue, the nonspecific GI complaints, hyperpigmentation of the skin, hyperkalemia and hypoglycemia, which are found on labs. And then the question is, though, finally, is this primary or secondary? And the way that we know that it's primary is the hyperpigmentation of the skin and hyperkalemia, which are generally only seen in primary or Addison's, but not in secondary. Follow-up question, question 27. Would the ACTH levels in the previously discussed patient be elevated or decreased? So remember, the patient in the last vignette had Addison's, aka primary adrenocortical insufficiency. So ACTH levels, are they going to be up or down? So they're going to be elevated. So primary adrenocortical insufficiency or Addison's disease is due to adrenal gland destruction, meaning the adrenal is not producing enough cortisol, also aldosterone, and this leads to increased ACTH. Pituitary is trying to increase the cortisol level. Of course, it's failing. Whereas secondary has a decreased ACTH because it's from pituitary failure. So that leads to decreased ACTH secretion. Just to follow up on the previous question, the increased ACTH is what causes the hyperpigmentation we see in the skin in Addison's. And then the decrease in aldosterone is what causes those electrolyte abnormalities like hyperkalemia, as well as hyponatremia too. So that's why you see those in primary, because of the abnormalities with the ACTH and the aldosterone. Question 28, a 36-year-old female presents to the office complaining of fatigue, constantly feeling cold, dry skin, and weight gain. If thyroid hormone levels were drawn in this patient, what would the levels of TSH and free T4 likely reveal? So that is going to be an elevated TSH and decreased free T4. Classic symptoms of hypothyroidism: fatigue, weight gain, cold intolerance, dry skin. And in hypothyroidism, we know the classic lab findings are going to be an elevation in the TSH and a decreased free T4. Question 29. Patient with hypothyroidism comes in for routine follow-up and to review labs she had done to evaluate her thyroid hormone levels. She takes 50 micrograms of levothyroxine daily and has been on this dose for the last 9 years with no issues. Labs come back indicating she is biochemically hypothyroidism. TSH is 11. Remember, the normal range is about 0.45 to 4.5. She states she has not made any changes since the last visit and assures you that she always takes her levothyroxine first thing in the morning, waits an hour before eating or taking any other pills. She's not started any new prescription medications, just an over-the-counter med she started a few weeks ago for some heartburn she'd been experiencing. What is the likely cause of this patient's sudden increase in TSH? So that's going to be the heartburn medication. So the over-the-counter med she's taking for her stomach, whether it's a PPI and an acid, levothyroxine requires an acidic environment to be effectively absorbed. That's why we don't do it with food or other pills. And as we know, PPIs and antacids reduce or neutralize the acid in the stomach. So, while other pills you can take within an hour, you know, your other cholesterol meds or your blood pressure medications, PPIs, as well as some antacids, vitamins, calcium, actually need a 4 hour buffer period. So while she thinks everything's fine, she's doing what she normally does, she's waiting an hour before taking this PPI. Certain medications and supplements like PPIs, calcium, iron, actually need a 4 hour buffer period, and that's what's causing the increased TSH we see in this patient. So certain meds, remember, need 4 hours rather than just the hour we see with most medications. Question 30, a 47-year-old female has recently started methimazole for treatment of Graves' disease. She often feels very jittery, anxious, and sometimes feels as if her heart is beating out of her chest. In addition to methimazole, what medication class can be used in this patient to rapidly improve her symptoms? So that would be beta blockers, propranolol, atenolol. Beta blockers alleviate the symptoms of hyperthyroidism that are caused by that increased beta adrenergic tone. So symptoms like tachycardia, those palpitations, anxiety, they can all potentially be eliminated or at least improved with beta blockers. Question 31, what would be the first line medication to use in a patient with acromegaly due to a pituitary adenoma? So the first line medication is going to be a somatostatin analog. So that's going to be octreotide most commonly. Another one is known as lanreotide. So somatostatin inhibits the release of growth hormone. That's why we use those somatostatin analogs. Question 32, a 42-year-old male presents to the office complaining of decreased libido and erectile dysfunction. He has a history of type 2 diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and bipolar disorder. And his medications include Zocor, amlodipine, metformin, and risperidone. Labs are drawn which reveal an elevated prolactin level. What would be the first line treatment option for this patient? So, first line treatment option for this patient is going to be discontinue the offending agent, which in this case is going to be the risperidone that he takes. So, this patient has hyperprolactinemia, and the cause is the risperidone he's taking. So, risperidone, as well as other dopamine antagonists like haloperidol, can lead to hyperprolactinemia. And the reason is because these agents are dopamine antagonists. So they block the effect of dopamine. And what does dopamine do? It's an inhibitor of prolactin. So decreased dopamine, more prolactin, and it can lead to hyperprolactinemia like we see in this patient. And the first line management will be to discontinue the risperidone and switch to something different for his bipolar disorder. Question 33. What medication can be used in a patient with primary hyperparathyroidism to lower serum calcium and serum PTH levels that is not a candidate for surgery? So that medication is something known as cinacalcet. It's a calcimimetic. It works by lowering the parathyroid hormone levels by increasing the sensitivity of calcium sensing receptor. So kind of tricks the body into thinking there's more calcium floating around than there actually is. So it doesn't produce as much PTH, and therefore you're going to produce less calcium. And remember, if a patient has osteoporosis, another medication class we can use in patients with primary hyperparathyroidism is bisphosphonates. Question 34, a patient with a history of type 1 diabetes presents with tachycardia, weakness, altered mental status, and fruity or acetone breath. Finger stick is done bedside, which reveals a blood glucose of 560, and his urine is positive for ketones. On physical exam, you know, deep, rapid, and labored breathing. These respirations are a compensatory mechanism for what acid-base disorder that is likely present in this patient? So the acid-base disorder that's likely present in this patient would be a high anion gap metabolic acidosis. Just remember that DKA is the D in mud pilers that we talked about, a mnemonic for all those acid-base, all the high anion gap metabolic acidosis. So this patient, it has what's known as Kussmaul respirations. It's a compensatory mechanism for the metabolic acidosis as the patient's experiencing. It's his body's way of trying to increase the rate and the depth of respiration to blow off more excess CO2. Question 35, patient presents to the ER after sustaining a head injury in a motor vehicle accident. Since the accident, he has been urinating more frequently than normal and has developed an insatiable thirst. His urine is dilute and a finger stick blood glucose reading was 98. What is the first line treatment for the likely diagnosis in this patient? It's kind of a tough one, but it's going to be desmopressin. So he has polyuria, polydipsia, sudden presentation. Should be suspecting diabetes insipidus. So they tell you the urine is dilute, the blood glucose is normal, so you can kind of rule out diabetes mellitus. And also, just because of the rapid onset, you should kind of rule out diabetes, but also they tell you the finger stick is normal. So now we just need to decide, is this central or nephrogenic? And they don't give you the results of a desmopressin stimulation test, so you just have to go by the history. So the patient's presenting with these symptoms after a head injury, and that's one of the causes of central diabetes insipidus. And so not only does it lead to central diabetes insipidus, we can kind of rule out a nephrogenic cause because they don't mention any medications that could have potentially caused it, any electrolyte abnormality, so we wouldn't really be suspecting nephrogenic. They specifically state that head injury, so we know the most likely diagnosis is central diabetes insipidus, and the first line treatment for that is going to be desmopressin. Question 36, 46-year-old male is diagnosed with SIADH. He has a history of seizures, asthma, hypothyroidism, and hyperlipidemia, and is taking atorvastatin, levothyroxine, albuterol inhaler, Lovaza, and carbamazepine. Discontinuation of which medication is recommended in this patient? So remember again, he's taking levothyroxine, atorvastatin, albuterol, Lovaza, and carbamazepine. So the med you're going to stop is going to be carbamazepine. So almost all anticonvulsants have the potential to cause SIADH, and carbamazepine in particular is the one that seems to be a popular one to ask about. So other medications, hydrochlorothiazide, some SSRIs, IV cyclophosphamide, they can all predispose a patient to SIADH, but definitely remember carbamazepines as well as your other anticonvulsants. Question 37, what screening test should be done annually for diabetic patients to screen for early signs of diabetic nephropathy? So that would be a urinary albumin, also known as another test for that is a spot urinary albumin to creatinine ratio. So albumin is a protein that's usually too large to get through a healthy functioning kidney. Once the kidney starts to get damaged, and like in diabetic nephropathy, it's no longer able to retain the albumin back into the body, so we start to see it spill out into the urine, and it's an early sign of diabetic nephropathy. So you're looking for any increase above 30 in the urinary albumin. Used to be called, and probably the term you're familiar with is microalbuminuria. It's not called that anymore. From 30 to 300, that's called moderately increased albuminuria, and then anything above 300 is called severely increased albuminuria. Question 38, what is the most common cause of diabetic ketoacidosis? So most common cause of DKA is going to be infection, like pneumonia, UTI. It's going to be your most common cause, just due to the counter-regulatory hormones like epinephrine that predispose these patients to DKA. Question 39, patient with hypocalcemia has contraction of facial muscles provoked by lightly tapping on the facial nerve just anterior to the ear. What is this known as? So this is going to be known as the Vostek sign. Vostek sign, which is spelled C-H-V-O-S-T-E-K sign. Question 40, a 64-year-old female with history of type 2 diabetes presents to the office due to her blood glucose running higher for the past few months. She's made dietary changes as well as increasing her activity level with no improvement in her blood glucose readings. She agrees to add another medication to her regimen, and you discuss a few medications with her, including empagliflozin, liraglutide, and glipizide. She states her only requirement is that the medication will not cause her to gain weight. Which of these three medications discussed should be avoided? So if you don't want her to gain weight, which med are you going to avoid? Remember the med options were empagliflozin, liraglutide, and glipizide. Which one are you going to avoid? So it's going to be glipizide. So glipizide is a sulfonylurea. It can cause weight gain. The other two listed, liraglutide is a GLP-1 receptor agonist. That actually causes weight loss. Actually, a couple of the GLP-1 receptor agonists have been turned into weight loss meds. They're rebranded, so those are really good weight loss meds, so definitely not liraglutide. And then empagliflozin, it's an SGLT2 inhibitor, can also cause weight loss. So the only one in these three meds is that's going to cause weight gain is glipizide. The way that I used to remember that is that I used to remember the sentence, if you sit too much, you can get fat, like in PA school. So if you sit too much, you can get fat. And then SIT stands for the three classes of diabetes meds that cause weight gain. That's going to be sulfonylureas, insulin, and TZDs. TZDs, remember, like rosiglitazone, pioglitazone. So those are the only ones that cause weight gain in diabetes. All of the other ones are either weight neutral or can cause weight loss. So if you sit too much, you can get fat. Sulfonylureas, insulin, TZD classes. Question 41, what diagnosis should be ruled out in a patient who has a radioactive iodine uptake scan of the thyroid performed that shows little to no iodine uptake, which is also known as a cold nodule? What should you rule out in this patient? That's going to be a malignancy. So these patients need further testing to rule out malignancy with normally a fine needle aspiration. Still really rare, even in a cold nodule, to see a thyroid malignancy, only about 5%. but you do need to rule that out in a cold nodule. Question 42, a 46-year-old male with a history of inflammatory bowel disease, hyperlipidemia, pancreatitis, renal failure, and trigeminal neuralgia is going to be started on metformin for his newly diagnosed type 2 diabetes. Which medical condition listed in his history would be a contraindication for starting metformin? Remember again, he has inflammatory bowel disease, hyperlipidemia, pancreatitis, renal failure, and trigeminal neuralgia. The one medical condition that's listed that would be a contraindication would be renal failure. Remember, due to the risk of lactic acidosis with metformin, we don't start patients with renal failure on metformin. Normally, the GFR cutoff is going to be less than 30, where it's absolutely contraindicated. Question 43, what is the most common cause of hyperthyroidism? So hyperthyroidism, most common cause. It's going to be Graves' disease. Question 44, 46-year-old female presents to the emergency department because she feels like her heart is beating out of her chest, and she's also complaining of a persistent headache. On exam, she is diaphoretic, has a pulse of 122, and a blood pressure of 162 over 108. Her labs show that her plasma fractionated metanephrines are significantly elevated. A CT of the head, abdomen, and pelvis are performed and discover a mass. For the likely diagnosis in this patient, where would the mass most commonly be located? So that would be the adrenals. This patient has a pheochromocytoma, which is evident by the classic triad of a headache, sweating, tachycardic, as well as being hypertensive, which is another key finding. And then, of course, the elevated metanephrines. So since a pheochromocytoma is a catecholamine-secreting adrenal tumor, the mass that we did on imaging on the CT would be found on the adrenals. So that would be the area we would see on the CT. Question 45, 67-year-old male with a history of type 2 diabetes presents to the office today complaining of shortness of breath that is increasingly getting worse. He's also noted some unexplained weight gain as well as swelling in his lower legs. On physical exam, pitting edema is noted in the lower extremity and rales are auscultated at the lung bases. He was started on a new oral diabetes medication a few months ago by his endocrinologist, but he cannot remember the name. Which class of diabetes medication was he likely started on that led to his current presentation? So that's going to be the TZD class, which is going to be a thiazolidinediones. It's the reason why we call it the TZD class. So that's going to be your rosiglitazone, your pioglitazone. So these meds can cause or exacerbate congestive heart failure, and they actually carry a black box warning for CHF. Another reason why these meds are not commonly used anymore. Question 46, 45-year-old male presents to the office complaining that his wedding band no longer seems to fit and some of his hats seem to be too small. He also complains of headaches as well as some visual changes. What would the initial test of choice be for this patient to screen for the likely diagnosis? So the screening test we would do is insulin-like growth factor, also known as serum IGF-1. So this patient has a clear presentation for acromegaly, which is caused from a growth hormone secreting pituitary adenoma, which is also known as a somatotroph adenoma. So we measure the serum IGF concentrations because they're elevated in virtually all patients with acromegaly, and they provide excellent discrimination from normal individuals. Remember, the actual name of the disease is based all upon whether or not the epiphyseal plate in the bone is closed yet. So in adults, it's obviously closed. We call it acromegaly. In children, it's not yet closed. We call it gigantism. Same thing, different name, just due to the epiphyseal plate closure. And then I used to remember that because acromegaly starts with an A, so that helps me remember A, adults, acromegaly. Question 47, a 72-year-old female presents to the office today for a routine checkup. She forgot to bring her medication list, but says she was started on a new medication for diabetes. She said all she can remember about the medication is that it's supposed to flush the glucose out through her urine. Which class of medication is this patient likely taking? So that would be an SGLT2 inhibitor like empagliflozin, canagliflozin, and those medications flush the excess glucose out through the urine. Question 48, what is the most common cause of primary hyperparathyroidism? Most common cause of primary hyperparathyroidism is going to be a parathyroid adenoma. Question 49, 86-year-old female was brought to the ER today by rescue. She was found in her apartment unconscious by a neighbor who called 911. On exam, her pulse is 46, her blood pressure is 82 over 52, and lab findings reveal her free T4 levels are so low they are undetectable. Family member who accompanies the patient today states she normally has a nurse who comes to the house each day to dispense her medications, but unbeknownst to the family, she has not showed up for over 3 weeks. What medication was this patient likely taking daily prior to her nurse not showing up? So that would be levothyroxine or Synthroid, or any other thyroid hormone replacements, really. This patient has what's known as myxedema coma. It's an extreme form of hypothyroidism that's evident in this patient due to the bradycardia, hypotension, extremely low free T4 levels. And these patients can also have hypothermia, hypoglycemia. It's generally seen in elderly patients. Sometimes it can be patients who are non-compliant with their thyroid hormones, but really the most common causes are going to be some acute precipitating event like MI or infection. Question 50, 36-year-old female presents to the office complaining of fatigue, polyuria, and recurrent candidal infections. Screening for what condition should be performed in this patient? So that would be screening for diabetes mellitus. So fatigue, polyuria, all very common in patients with diabetes, but then the key is that recurrent candidal infections, which are common in diabetic patients due to the increased glucose in the urine. So glucose promotes adhesion of candida to either the vaginal epithelium or the buccal mucosa, which can impair phagocytosis. It can lead to recurrent vulvovaginal candidiasis or even thrush. All right, that was it. Question 50, we are done. I hope that was helpful. Please let me know if it's helping you in the comments. And I thank you so much for listening to my podcast, and thank you so much for the support. And good luck in PA school. Good luck in your pants, your pannery, and your EORs.